Today is April 27th, 2010, and this is episode 1.5 of FatCast. I am Leslie Kinzel of FatChinista.com, and as always, joining me is Marianne Kirby of TheRotund.com. This is not quite a full second episode, but rather a mini episode on the concept of the fatosphere, which, for those who aren't aware, is the word applied to both a popular aggregate feed called Notes from the Fatosphere, which collects fat-related blogs, and is sometimes also used to describe all blogs dealing with fat issues and size acceptance. It is highly unlikely that we will be able to do these podcasts every 3 days as a rule, but for now, consider this a chaser to our inaugural episode. Somewhere there's music. All right. I think what we want to start off with is talking about the concept of the fatosphere in general and what is the fatosphere and where did that name come from? I don't actually remember where that came from. I sort of remember the original conversations happening, but I don't remember who originally said the fatosphere. Do you remember that?
It was Fat Fu, I think.
Okay.
Because she's the one who put the original notes list together.
That would make sense then.
And she, I think, coined the term as well. I don't know that it was being used before then.
Okay. Because I remember there being sort of conversations about, is this the best word that we could come up with?
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea that O-sphere is something that's applied to blogospheres all over, but it's generally sort of the feminist blogosphere or the political blogosphere or whatever. I think that maybe just adding fatosphere and just making it all one word was, you know, shorthand or something. I don't know. But I remember sort of when that happened, and I feel like the concept of having a community of fat bloggers mostly came from when the feed was first put together, because I feel like that was the first time that people really started to connect with other fat bloggers in fairly large numbers. And I think at the time there wasn't really a dominant sort of voice in the discussion. And these are just my memories. I'm not sure if you remember it differently, but I remember when it started, Shapely Prose was like one, you know, blog, which is now sort of the most popular one, but Shapely Prose was just one voice out of many on the original feed.
Well, what happened around that point, Kate and I started our blogs right around the same time, and that was kind of when we initially started talking. And then there was this sort of, I don't know, explosion in fat blogging. Like, it put on a lot of weight is the horrible pun I'm going to make there. Oh, God, I can't believe I just went there.
I'm so glad you went there.
I just can't help it. It's funny to me. And the sort of discussion at the time was that, wow, now there is a lot of us. Yes, we are community building. And it was a very positive sort of collective blogging experience. And, you know, everybody was reading everybody else and commenting. And I mean, obviously, that was like 2.5, 3 years ago.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. That's sort of why I keep casting my memory back and thinking what else was going on at that time. But yeah, it was a while ago.
Yeah. And I think that Kate and I, by virtue of just getting in a little bit early, you know, got to watch a lot of that happen, which was really exciting because it was like, oh, this upswelling of fat acceptance online.
Right. And it was sort of being heralded as this amazing movement of individuals who are all writing on this subject. And I don't know, I sort of at some point in this mini podcast want to talk a little bit about whether it's a community or a movement or just an aggregation of individual feeds that happen to deal with the same subject, but which are not necessarily within in agreement with each other. And before we do that, I sort of want to talk about the book title.
Okay.
Because I know that there's been some stuff around the book title.
Well, the book title that we we put on our proposal was not lessons from the Fatosphere. When we put together the book proposal, we actually brainstormed a bunch of titles, and there was one that we both really kind of liked, and it was Results Not Typical.
Nice. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. We dug that a lot. And then through like the process with our agent, it became Screw Inner Beauty, which is actually still the Australian title. I really dig the Australian title. It's like Screw Inner Beauty, how to trash the diet and self-loathing and get on with your life.
That's kind of amazing. It's just sort of an interesting little insight into how books are marketed, but that sounds like, it's not necessarily a better or worse thing, but it sounds like a different book than the one in the U.S. to me.
One of the Spanish books, because there's two Spanish editions, there's Spain Spanish and Latin American Spanish. Mm-hmm. I can't remember which one because I don't speak Spanish, but one of them, the title is To the Devil with Diet. And that, I cannot even tell you, like, Ed translated it for me. And I'm like, are you serious? That is awesome.
No. That is really pretty great. I gotta be honest with you.
To the devil with diet. So I mean, the book title evolved a lot, and it sort of depended on the market, and it depended on the publisher. And our publisher in the U.S. I love you, Penguin Perigee. Our publisher in the U.S. really, really liked the word fatosphere. Like, not even our editor, like the publisher at Perigee was like, that's a really great word. Let's use it. So the whole concept of lessons from the Fatosphere was really driven by our publisher. They liked the idea that it was these voices coming from a group of blogs. It was stuff that we had learned as well by being part of the Fatosphere.
Right.
And by talking to all of these other women as well, especially once we started including essays from other people. So that was sort of, I don't know, I think that's one reason I actually am kind of fond of the word, because people like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
people respond to it. It sounds like a community. It sounds like sort of a collection of true believers, I guess, is one weird way of putting it. And
it's got the word fat in it. And anything that gets the word fat out there, like, that was one of the concerns about the book title, is whether or not someone would buy a book with the word fat on the cover if they were the kind of person who needed the book.
Right.
And so I think our sales right now are still skewed more towards online sales. And the theory is that that is one reason why.
Interesting. So, interesting. That could very well be. I mean, and again, that's sort of an interesting little marketing, you know, reality. I mean, your publisher is primarily probably thinking about how many books can we actually move into, you know, people's hands in exchange for money.
So yeah.
That's really sort of fascinating.
Yeah.
I feel like there was sort of, and I don't want to say a backlash because I don't know if that's fair, but I do feel like there was to some extent a conversation that happened after that came out, the book came out, because a lot of people were sort of questioning, it almost came across like this is repping for the whole of the Fatosphere. So anyone who wasn't included automatically felt like, well, hey, I'm in the Fatosphere too, and why am I not there? And as we talked on the previous episode a little bit about how then Kate was sort of deemed queen of the Fatosphere by some media, I don't remember, some article. It was like one article, and people really sort of got very upset by that because they felt like, you know, maybe I don't want this person representing me. Which, again, is fine. It's totally fine to do that and to represent yourself, and I'm not saying that anyone should not feel their feelings, I guess. But, you know, it sort of became almost a, I mean, I'm seeing this now. I mean, we sort of have little flutters, amongst in the fat blogosphere on a semi-regular basis where, and it still seems to be surrounded around the feed, who is now actually managed by Bree over at Fat Lot of Good. And I will include that link in the, show notes. But the feed is now managed over there. And I feel like there's still this idea that if you're on the feed, you're sort of like, what's the word I'm looking for? You're sort of like accepted as
you're part
blogger.
Of that community of true believers.
And if you get cast out of the feed, then that means you are cast out of fat acceptance. And I definitely would, you know, usually in what, and I've had quite a few questions about this on FormSpring too from people who want to know, do you think the fatosphere is a clique? Or do you think, and I think in most cases, this is sort of code for actually talking about the feed and not just, I mean, obviously anyone can blog about body politics and fat. You don't have to be on the feed to do that. Now, if you're on the feed, I understand that improves traffic a whole lot. I don't obsess over stats myself, so I haven't really kept track of that on my own blog. But I know that for a lot of people, that's where the vast majority of their traffic comes from. So getting thrown off the feed, yeah, it affects who, you know, how many people are actually coming around to read their blog. And I understand that. And I understand being upset about that. But at the same time, I mean, I don't know where I'm still sort of sorting out my feelings about that. I don't really think of it so much as a clique because there are lots of people who are on the feed and who blog on these issues that I don't agree with universally. And we hear a lot from people who are angry with fatosphere in general that it's sort of a hive mind or that you have to agree with everyone in order to be a part of it. And that has very much not been my experience.
What's really interesting to me about the fat feed or the fatosphere feed or notes from the fatosphere, I mean, it's got so many different names at this point. What's really interesting to me when I hear those comments, though, is that it's just a fat acceptance feed. Like, there's no special handshake you have to learn to get on. It was really frustrating for a lot of people for a while because one of the reasons Bree took it over is that, you know, it had gone a little, it was hard to get things updated.
You know, there was
a lot of real life happening. And when real life is happening, updating like a feed aggregate is not priority number one.
Right.
So I think that some of the initial bad feeling came from people who like waited a month or two and never heard anything and thought that meant they weren't good enough or something. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, it was circumstances. And I think now there has continued to be a lot of talk over the, you know, the past 2 years or whatever about whether to let blogs that talk about dieting onto the fatosphere feed. And I know that like some of us are a lot more militant than others about our blogs being no diet zones, that sort of thing. But I don't even know what the official fatosphere stance on that is right now. Like I just know what's going on in my space.
Bree has been pretty steadfast that if you are going to talk about dieting, you will not be on the feed. And I mean talk about dieting insofar as not so much talking about dieting from a critical perspective. That is okay. But talking about dieting from or about health and weight in ways that are problematic or, you know, sort of scare quote triggering for people.
That's what I thought.
That you can't, that, you know, she, and there have been a couple of people who have been in the past few months. I don't remember the blog. I mean, I'm sure if you go back, you can figure it out, who have been kicked from the feed for sort of repeatedly not keeping in tune with these rules. And I really respect Bree's position on that. I know from our experience moderating Fashionista on LiveJournal that moderating something like that that is used by thousands of people is a huge, huge headache because there will always be people who are upset with the choices that you make. But she has been really sort of strict about that. And I think that to some extent is a good thing because the argument that we all have repeated 1,000 times ad nauseum has always been there is a place where it is safe for you to talk about dieting. It is everywhere else in the world. The point of a safe diet, you know, and I use safe again in scare quotes. It's not really safe, but you know,
safer.
I wish if this were video, I just have my fingers up by my head the whole time. But the idea of having a space where you can go in and be relatively sure that no one is going to be, you know, sort of foisting body negativity on you, that's unusual. And that is something that's worth preserving and protecting. And I think that that is really what Bree is trying to do. And I give her mad props for that because I don't think it's easy.
I also think going back to your earlier, oh, I want to talk about this later. So we're kind of going full circle, woo-hoo! I guess.
We might actually keep this under 30 minutes.
Now you've jinxed it. Going back to this whole idea of community and that sort of thing, I mean, it sucks because we don't want to exclude anyone because we have been excluded and experienced societal oppression and, you know, negative bias and all of that stuff. But part of being a social justice movement means establishing some really basic, you know, premises. Mm-hmm. And if one of those premises is dieting is not going to save us all, then we kind of have to stick to that in our spaces. I mean, I know it's mean to the people who want to talk about that, but if we're going to be taken seriously as a social justice movement, which we want to be taken seriously as a social justice movement, we have to have these sort of lines in the sand.
I completely agree. And I think we've seen this a lot with the LiveJournal community too, that you'll have people who come in and get very upset, like new people who come in and get very upset when they are told you can't talk about dieting or you can't talk about how awesome your weight loss surgery was, or you can't. I mean, these are just topics that you have lots of other places that you can talk about. In this space, we would prefer that you restrain yourself from bringing these up because this is supposed to be a space that is about body positivity. And a lot of these people will sort of fight us early on, and then I know you've seen this happen too a bazillion times over, where after they've been in the community for a few months, ultimately they come around and think, wow, it's great that this place is here, that I can come here. Like it almost takes a little while to sort of click that a place that you can go to and not hate on your body and not be focused on your diet is an unusual and special and, dare I say, sacred environment. And it's,
you know,
not
what else it
it's
is?
Not something that we find in our day-to-day lives.
You know what else it is? It's scary. I mean, so much of conversation in the, I don't know, the quote-unquote real world, so much of that conversation revolves around the social niceties of body hatred and self-denigration. Whether you're out to lunch with women from the office or, you know, complimenting someone on an outfit, there are social rituals that often involve, you know, the sort of body hate that we're all supposed to have as proper women in our society.
And I mean, even body hate that we bond over in a lot of circumstances. I can't tell you how often, and I know you've had this experience too, where I will meet a stranger, you know, and they will assume that, you know, they can sort of bond with me about their diet. And
yeah.
That it blows my mind because I'll be standing there thinking, where am I? What is going on? Because I work so hard in my day-to-day life to try to live free of that, or to, if nothing else, to try to remove myself from the circumstances when they arise.
Here's where I sort of expose my deep and wide amounts of nerdery.
You are really wide. It's true.
It's true. It's because I'm fat. So I'm part of this online role-playing group that's kind of anonymous.
Not anymore.
Shut up. And there's all of these women. I mean, it's primarily women playing. And it's been really interesting because, you know, all of my friends online are like, okay, it's Marianne, shut up about your diet. But these people don't know that. And I have been expected to partake in that bonding over diet, that, oh, yay, I lost a pound and a half. And it's like I've lost all ability to even fake it. It's kind of amazing. It's so bizarre to be faced with that.
So what do you say? So what do you say when that happens?
Generally, it's all over chat as well, so I can kind of flail around and feel like an idiot and then change the subject. And there are a couple of people who, well, there's one person who hasn't really gotten the I'm glad that you're happy subject change, you know, thing. She keeps bringing it up.
he's waiting for that. I mean, that congratulations, that's part of the, you know, sort of social expectation.
But so when people don't have that, I feel like it's actually kind of scary because suddenly you have no expected social rules anymore. What do you talk about?
We are subverting the dominant paradigm.
It's true, Leslie. It's true.
Oh, that's funny. But yeah, no, I think you're completely right that
it's scary. I mean, even these women in a completely anonymous science fiction setting pretending to be other people are talking about their diets because that is how we are supposed to bond with one another.
And that fascinates me too, because in that particular circumstance, that's not even a world in which you could tell the difference.
I know.
Like, you could just as easily respond and say, yeah, man, you sound a lot thinner.
I have to say, I keep waiting for someone to be like, y'all sound fat.
If I ever find out where your top secret lair is, I'll come in and say that and make your day.
It's top secret. You can't come in.
Anyway, coming back to the topic, but yeah, I think that the idea of it being scary is definitely an issue too, that because this is something that, and particularly for people who are really, really, when you're on a diet and your really whole life is focused upon this goal, it's hard to think about anything else. And at least this was my experience during my many years of dieting. And because it becomes the most important thing in your life, anytime you meet with someone else who says, you know, hey, how's it going? How's the job? How's the family? You know, how are the kids? Whatever. Your knee jerk isn't to say, oh, the job's going good, I got a promotion, oh, the kids are growing up and they're brilliant and I love them. It's to focus on, well, I'm on this diet. And I think that is to take that away from people is sort of a shocking, scary thing. That, you know, the idea that you can go, that there is a place where you can go in and talk about, I worked so hard and I lost 50 pounds and you're not going to be congratulated on it. I think that is sort of unnerving. And I'm not saying that in a yay, fuck that person sort of way. I'm saying in just to acknowledge that's sort of tilting reality in a weird way, that that's not the response that you would expect in 90% of the world that, you know, you would, well, not the whole world, but at least American culture.
I think that it's incredibly valuable and difficult to maintain that 10% of space where that is not the norm.
Yeah.
And I think that it is vital to a lot of people at this point to have that kind of space.
And I think too that it sort of cultivates a change in culture, like a broader change in culture, the more people that have that experience and sort of realize, oh, maybe there are, you know, ways of thinking about my body and thinking about my appearance and thinking about my health that are different from what the messages, you know, that I get from the media and the messages that I get from my friends and family and from pretty much every social space that I exist in. Maybe there's another way of thinking about that. And I think that that is revolutionary. And I think ultimately that's why we have so many people on Fashionista who rebel violently in their early exposure to that. But then later come back and say, I mean, sometimes we have the most violent rebels will be the ones who are the first on the scene when someone else says the same thing later on. And I think that's
the emails about like, oh, you need to go look at this thread because there's body negativity going on.
And I love those emails.
A, from a practical purpose, because we can't read every thread.
Right.
But B, because I do recognize some of those names.
Mm-hmm.
And it's indicative of what a transformative space or what a transformative thing a space like that can be.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that sort of comes back to the question of whether, you know, if we're going to define the fatosphere as a space in which that kind of body negativity is, if not completely verboten, but is at least restrained and not as acceptable as it is other places, does it also have to be a community? I don't know that it does. I don't know that, you know, it has to be a hive mind or that everyone has to agree on everything else. I don't think everyone in the Fatosphere does agree.
Oh,
there are Fatosphere bloggers whose politics are way out there for me. And,
yes.
And that's okay because, you know, in most circumstances, they maintain blogs where they don't talk about body negativity and dieting and weight loss and all of that. And as long as that's the case, I have no problem with the fact that I disagree with them philosophically on, like, most of life as it can be experienced in this dimension. That's okay as long as, you know, we sort of have that shared agreement that this is a space that is insulated from that kind of negative talk.
I actually think it's really important for people in the Fatosphere to have these differing politics because if the biggest difference between us is that one person voted for Hillary in the primary and one person voted for Obama in the primary, that's a huge portion of the population, no pun intended.
It's true.
That isn't going to be represented and isn't going to relate to the message. I mean, as much as I rail against the politics that some other people have, I want them talking to the other people that have those same politics mm-hmm. because those people aren't going to listen to me.
Yeah. And absolutely. I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that there are aspects of the Fatosphere that aren't diverse enough. I think I'm sure we both agree on this. There are not enough people of color in the Fatosphere. There's not much in the way of representing disability. There's not much in the way of representing various socioeconomic classes. There's certainly not much diversity in terms of gender, which is a huge, huge problem for me, and it's something that really bugs me, but it's also one of those things where, well, what the hell do I do about it? I mean, I can't go pulling people off the street and saying, you'll be a fat blogger now, as much as I would like to. And that's a part of that frustration and that wanting to have a more diverse group of voices talking, but not sort of feeling stymied in terms of how do I make that happen. That's just a classic problem with almost any social movement.
I have to say, it kind of is on us to make the movement as it exists now genuinely welcoming beyond lip service. And the Fatosphere has fallen down on that in
specific
instances that have been kind of, oh my fucking God, I can't believe I'm watching this happen on the internet.
It's so true.
And
some of them have happened on my blog.
it's so incredibly frustrating, but I also have to respect the people who are like, no, the Fatosphere is in the corner right now.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you there that it's we have to build a movement that is inclusive. And if I was coming across as saying that, oh, there's nothing we can do, that's not what I'm saying. I was speaking more to that sort of frustration is sort of, I mean, we've seen that in feminism, that, you know, feminism tends to be a white women province. And that sucks. That sucks about feminism. It's a big part of the reason why I tend not to identify as a feminist, because I have a lot of problems with the whiteness of it and the cisgenderedness of it. And, you know, the fact that sometimes class is not really observed much. These are failures within that movement, I think.
Yes.
And I have a hard time. And I definitely think that the lack of diversity in the Fatosphere as it exists is a failure in the movement.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that, too, that the problem with that is a lot of people don't know why it's a failure or they don't perceive it as a failure.
It's one of the reasons I get really frustrated with the Fatosphere because you... And with, I guess, individual social justice movements in general, it's because you can't just have a conversation about one kind of social justice. They're all interrelated.
Intersectionality for the win.
But I mean, we can't just talk about, you know, I hate to say it, but especially with fat, you can't just talk about fat because it is incredibly gendered. It is linked to class and race and all of these other things.
And disability.
And disability. And you can't not just pretend those subjects don't exist, but a lot of people who are making up the Fatosphere right now don't necessarily have the social justice background to understand how all of the social justice movements are linked. And so I think that it's sort of a falling down of not education, not intelligence, but just thinking about it.
I talked about that a little bit in a post I did a while back that was talking about the old, you know, sort of feminist adage of liberal feminists want a piece of the pie, but radical feminists want a whole different pie.
Right.
And I sort of put that in the context of fat acceptance insofar as I feel like many of the people who are in the nascent levels of fat acceptance are still in that phase of I just want my fair share.
Yeah.
A lot of times they're not as invested in changing culture completely.
Yeah.
Which is what I am invested in and what I think you are invested in. A lot of us, the war horses, I guess, are invested in, for lack of a better word.
I'm like, war horses? Are you going to call us battle axes? Because that's charming.
We are Thundercats. The Thundercats of fat acceptance. But yeah, no, I seriously think that to some extent, yeah, it's not a foregone conclusion that the more time people spend in the movement, the more radicalized they get. That's absolutely not something that we can assume. But at the same time, I also feel like that's having some representation on that is a healthy thing because that's where most people tend to start. But yeah. We also have to be, you know, sort of consciously working towards building inclusivity and intersectionality as norms of the conversations that happen on the fatosphere.
This kind of, I'm sitting here like slump shouldered, like, oh, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about in the first episode, like the official podcast episode, unlike this emergency podcast episode, where we were talking about, you know, the who gets to be the leaders of the fat acceptance movement. And part of it is just whoever happens to be the most visible at the moment. But in the context of, is this a community? And we've talked about this before, like, If we are going to be a social justice community and we are going to make these things part of the bedrock of what fat acceptance stands for, then maybe we do have to have leaders. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been really a proponent of the leaderless community model, as have you. But I mean, if we're all... If we're wanting it to go this way, I mean, I don't know.
I don't know if it's so much about, I think to some extent it's about having direction. And I think having leadership is one way of having direction in this kind of movement. But you can also, and we see this to some extent with the moderation of the, not to go back to that again, but the moderation of the LiveJournal community. We have a huge group of mods and we all sort of talk and work things out by consensus. And we're all pretty radical, all of us who work in that, and that sort of helps us build consensus a lot easier. And it also makes it easier to say, no, you cannot talk about dieting, end of discussion, when the time comes, because we're all pretty steadfastly in agreement there. And so I think, and I'm still, I violently resist the leader sort of, model, I suppose, because I think that we can, I think that there's a way of driving and directing a movement without necessarily having a head on that movement. Because as we talked about in the previous episode, NAFA is no longer the sole protector of fat acceptance. It really has become this very individual movement, and there's, with self-publishing being what it is and blogging being what it is, there's a lot more voices from a lot of different perspectives. And I think that is incredibly valuable, but I really feel like there has to be a way for those of us who are the most invested and who have been doing this for a while to sort of, and I think you and I are doing that right now to some extent by having this conversation, but we are not the leaders.
You know, I'm sitting here and I'm having one of those life moments, like, holy shit, how did my life come to this? Because Leslie, you have to understand, I was like vice president of Young Republicans my junior year of high school.
Oh, you're out now.
I know, right? I'm like a reformed Republican. I was a fiscal conservative. I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah, but okay, so we are agreed that there has to be some way to sort of steer the fat acceptance movement.
And I think the best way to do that really is to make sure these conversations are happening. You know, I think that that is the most immediate way of continuing this. And we saw that back in the Stone Age which actually was like a year and a half now, like 2 years ago or something now, when Tara had posted on, I'll link this in the show notes, put a post on my blog about intersectionality and the problems with fat acceptance is sort of ignoring race as a factor. It's a great post and people blew up all over it. And yeah. There have been a couple other posts on fashionista.com. All of these are from guest bloggers because I am, you know, I'm smart enough to know when I should get someone smarter than me to write on a subject. But there have been other posts on fashionista.com dealing with cultural appropriation that have likewise blown up because people are just not used to having these conversations and they tend to respond sort of vigorously to them.
And when someone starts a cultural appropriation post on Fashionista, the live journal community, I know I may as well take the day off of work.
Yeah, it's going to be completely out of hand. That's pretty much a foregone conclusion. And because these are subjects that just people are not accustomed to having rational conversations about. And if you're not familiar with the language and the thinking behind it, well, of course, it's going to come across as crazy talk to you, or it's going to come across as personally attacking to you. And that's understandable. But at the same time, it's only through pushing through these conversations and pushing through the initial discomfort that they involve that we can learn things and that we can make a social justice movement that really is just.
Yes.
And I can't believe I just said all that and I hadn't written it down because it sounded like a speech.
It was really good.
All right. I think we need to wrap up.
Well, we do have to talk about one more thing. We have to talk about the importance of citing your sources, as it were.
All right.
Which was also on our list of things to talk about.
Yes, it was.
There, I'm so bad with chronology, and I couldn't find the links to it. But there was a situation where
you have a plane
woman
going
of color
by.
Blogger was not credited for like the ideas and thoughts that she had had and blogged about that led directly to some stuff that a white woman blogger wrote about, and you know there was not any accreditation going on, and it was sort of disappearing the women of color who were blogging on the topics. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time, I guess it's been like a year and a half, 2 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. That was the first time in the context of blogging that I had really thought about it's not just about the courtesy of directing traffic back to the thing that you read that inspired you. It is also a sort of fundamental thing we have to do so that people who are originating these thoughts get the credit for them that they deserve. You know, if you are truly thinking about something for the very first time or something has completely shifted your perspective, you know, that thing that you have read has the potential to do that for other people as well. I mean, it's kind of vital that you link to that.
And
I think that we do have situations in the fatosphere where 12 different people all talk about the same thing at the same time, sort of spontaneously, because there's some sort of, I don't know, fat molecule in our brain broadcasting the subject or something. But I do think that citing where your inspiration is coming from is pretty important.
Absolutely, particularly if it's driving traffic to a source that may not otherwise get the attention it deserves. And I think I totally agree that that's incredibly vitally important. I actually feel bad when I'll blog about something and I'll get a comment sent from someone saying, oh, I just read about this the other day, and they post the link. And I always want to comment back and be like, I swear to God, I did not steal this from you, that, oh, I thought of it because of X, Y, and Z, and sort of over explain things. Most of the time I tend to think, well, this is good. The link is there, and this is part of having this, the beauty and magic of blogging is, if you want to call it that, is, is, you know, being able to link to other people and being able to share ideas in this very immediate and instant way.
Yes. And I do think that having the link there is kind of what makes it magical. I mean, if somebody's like, oh, I blogged on this the other day, I don't know that you're necessarily obligated to say, oh, well, I thought of it because of X, Y, Z. But I think that you might be obligated to, I don't know, let them put their link there, for example.
Right. Which, and again, like I said, I like when that happens. I actually think it's kind of interesting and serendipitous when that does happen, because, again, going back to...
I was just using you as an example.
Just having... oh, I know. Just having a variety of voices on a subject is... Even if it's the same subject, and even if they... The other link has taken issue with something I said, even if they weren't attributing it to me because they hadn't read my post yet. Even when we're disagreeing, that's the conversation. And that's why blogging and self-publishing is so unique, because it allows for instant feedback and dialogue to happen. Whereas traditionally, if I printed up, well, even in my lifetime, I was going to go way back, but I'm going to talk about in the period of time that I've actually been alive.
Leslie in the Wayback Machine.
When I was in high school, I had a lot of friends who printed zines. And I wrote for a lot of their zines. And it was great fun. And, you know, we'd be at Kinko's at 3 o'clock in the morning making copies of their zines. And that was great. But there was very little feedback. I mean, and there was almost no direct feedback. It was incredibly rare that someone would take the time to actually pluck out a CD review that I had written to tell me, oh, that was really great, because there's that connection and that conversation just wasn't, it was just a lot harder to have. Whereas now with, and I'm not saying that zines are like old and dead and horrible. I still have immense respect for zines and I think they are awesome, but it's a different way of communicating. With blogs and self-publishing, you have this sort of instant feedback, and there's always this sort of urgency about having that conversation and making sure, well, if I blogged about this 10 minutes ago, I want to make sure it gets up here as soon as possible.
That's why I've blogged at the Rotund for 3 years. I realized it's been 3 years, which I don't know. It feels like forever in internet time. And I've been on LiveJournal for 10 years, which,
wow,
floors me. And it is. It's like, I can't keep a diary or a journal to save my damn life, but apparently I can write some crap on LiveJournal almost every day for 10 years. So there's so much to be said just from a motivational standpoint about that feedback and that conversation. And I think that the more we have that conversation, the richer the content becomes. I mean, that's why I wanted to have these conversations with you, because I think it's through conversation that we clarify our points, that we find ourselves on more solid, I don't know, argumentative ground, all of that sort of thing.
I agree. All right. Well, I think we ticked off all our bullet points.
I think we have.
So we will wrap up. And this is Fat Cast, and I am Leslie Kinzel.
I am Marianne Kirby.
And we will have a regular non-mini episode for you, hopefully early next week. So watch for it. Thanks for listening.
Like episode 1.5.
Thanks for listening, y'all. Bye.
You have been listening to FatCast episode 1.5. The music you have heard in this podcast is by Alo Django, off the album Swing and Dance. Fatcast is shared with you under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license.